Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Insurrection aftermath. The proposal for a bipartisan commission to investigate the violent assault on the Capitol by Trump supporters meets Republican opposition in the Senate. Then the origins of COVID. President Biden orders intelligence officials to redouble efforts to uncover the genesis of the pandemic, including its possible emergence from a Chinese laboratory. And the cost of war. Hundreds of thousands of veterans return home with illnesses they say are due to their exposure to burn pits, and they struggle to get benefits from the Veterans Affairs Department.
All the contaminants from the burn pits, I was basically breathing those in every other day at a high level and didn't even realize it at the time.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. It is ambitious and historic in its price tag of $6 trillion. President Biden's first federal budget proposal looks to transform the economy from transportation to education, all the while confronting climate change. Our Yamiche Alcindor joins me now with more on this blueprint of priorities. So, hello, Yamiche. Tell us, what more do we know about this proposed budget document that the president is expected to unveil tomorrow?
That's right. Well, President Biden is expected to unveil a $6 trillion budget. And if passed in its form currently, it would be the highest federal sustained spending since World War II. Now, the White House says this is a big budget because we have big problems and big challenges ahead. I want to walk you through what's in this budget based on what we've been talking, what White House sources have been telling us all day. There's $8 trillion in total spending by 2031. There's $6 trillion in spending for fiscal year 2022. There's $1.52 trillion in discretionary spending. Now, that's things like education, housing, public health, and climate change. And then there's $1 trillion in deficits for at least the next decade. Now, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki was out today. She said the budget that we will see more details on tomorrow, it reflects the priorities of President Biden, and that is about creating jobs and doing the types of things that he's been talking about, which include having generational investments in Americans.
And Yamiche, what is the White House saying about why so much money is needed at this point, and what's the expectation in terms of Republicans' willingness to support even a part of this?
Well, president budgets never really pass in the way that they're presented to Congress. That said, the White House is saying this needs to be a big investment because there are so many challenges ahead for the American people. I've been talking to officials from the Office of Management and Budget, as well as White House sources, and they all underscored the idea that President Biden wants to really invest in a way that changes people's lives, that's transformational. They also said that Republicans, they're hoping will come along, but they're also understanding that Republicans, as they're still dealing with the infrastructure deal that is separate from this, that this is really still going to be a very contentious fight, but they're hoping that this budget, at least in large part, is passed.
All right, Yamiche Alcindor following it today for us at the White House. Thank you, Yamiche. And now we turn to Capitol Hill, where four powerful advocates join the push for an independent commission to look at January the 6th. Lisa Desjardins reports.
An unexpected and emotional appeal on Capitol Hill today as senators considered a bill to establish a commission to investigate January 6th.
Usually I'm staying in the background and I couldn't stay quiet anymore.
The mother of Officer Brian Sicknick, who died after the attack on the Capitol, joined by his longtime partner and two Capitol police officers injured that day, made the rounds to urge the commission's passing.
That day should have never happened. It was terrible. And so we want members of Congress to ensure that it doesn't happen again.
At least 15 Republican senators agreed to sit down with the group. Some, like Susan Collins, are trying to find a compromise version.
We owe it to the brave men and women who defended our lives that day, and in some cases did so at the cost of their lives.
H.R. 3233. A bill to establish the National Commission to investigate the January 6th attack.
The bill is passed.
The House passed their version of a January 6th commission last week, with 35 Republicans joining Democrats in support. It's modeled directly after the commission to investigate the attacks on September 11th, which passed in 2002 with overwhelming support from both parties. The proposed commission would have 10 seats total, equally split, Democrats and Republicans. The chair would be appointed by Democrats, the vice chair by Republicans. Subpoenas for witnesses or documents would require agreement from at least one member on each side. In the nearly 6 months since the insurrection, the Department of Justice has arrested over 400 people. Senate Republicans opposing the commission say Democrats want to score political points and that other investigations underway are sufficient.
The agency that I have the most faith in and the other side of the aisle did on many other matters would be the FBI.
There's no new fact about that day. We need the Democrats' extraneous commission to uncover.
Frustrated Democrats pushed back.
The Democrats have basically given everything they've asked for, any impediment that would have been there, and there's no reason not to now, unless you just don't want to hear the truth.
The truth of the matter seems to be that Senate Republicans oppose the commission because they fear that it might upset Donald Trump and their party's midterm messaging.
And Lisa joins me now. So, Lisa, as you reported, it was just a little over a week ago that the House passed legislation to create this commission. Tell us what's going on in the Senate now.
Judy, this appears to be the critical night for decision-making on the January 6th commission. We expect the U.S. Senate to vote tonight on this idea, whether to move it forward or to block it. We don't know exactly when, but we do know it's got an uphill fight. Right now, it needs 10 Republicans in order to move forward, but only three so far. You can look at three of them. Susan Collins of Maine, as well as two others, are in support of this bill right now. Now, I want to talk about the reasons why people say that this commission is needed. It's important to talk about that. Some say, point out, there is no definitive account right now of what happened on January 6th. That includes those who attacked the Capitol, their reasons for attacking the Capitol, how much political rhetoric played into that, as well as the failures of security at the Capitol and at the Defense Department. There are conflicting versions all around, and there's no definitive account of that. In addition, Capitol Police would like some leadership who were responsible for security to be held accountable. This report could do that. Other Capitol Police tell me they want their stories told. I spoke to one who was involved in the battle for the Rotunda, a harrowing account that has not been told. All of this happening as, of course, Capitol security itself is still unresolved. The National Guard has left, but little else has changed really since January 6th in major configuration.
So it is clear, Lisa, that many people are saying this has to happen. It's necessary. Why then so many Republicans opposing it?
It's an important question. I've talked to dozens of Republicans who oppose this. Their number one reason, Judy, is they say they think this is a political smear attempt. They don't trust Democrats. They believe Democrats will hijack this commission, no matter how bipartisan or even it is, in order to try and make them look bad in an election year. Another argument that they have is they say that the timeline is just too short for this. In addition, they say they don't think it's likely that the events of January 6th can be repeated because it was a unique circumstance with rally outside the Capitol, unprepared security forces. To that argument, I have to say, I have to point to what's happening across the country. Some 430 people so far have been arrested, and the FBI even today sent out an alert looking for photos and help in identifying people. And we know that judges ruling in these cases are saying they believe there is still a threat from this idea that the election was fraudulent. I want to read some words of Judge Amy Berman Jackson. She is a district court judge here in Washington, D.C. She wrote in one of her rulings denying a release for a suspect. She said, 6 months later, after January 6th, the canard that the election was stolen is being repeated daily on major news outlets and from the corridors of power in state and federal government, not to mention in the near daily fulminations of the former president. This is part of the January 6th commission debate, the idea that you cannot move past it without addressing a still thought that's in this country that some see as very dangerous, even at this moment.
So if, Lisa, as your reporting says, the votes are not there to pass it, what happens next?
then it falls back to what Speaker Pelosi is planning to do in the House, which is a select committee to look into this. And that, of course, could get some answers, but that will be more partisan, more like the Benghazi investigation that Republicans led in years past than the 9/11 Commission. It could still not move past the feelings of January 6th, just sort of bubble them up again. Judy?
Well, it's an important story, so important to be following this. Lisa Desjardins, we thank you. In the day's other news, Senate Republicans put forward a counteroffer on rebuilding infrastructure. It totals $928 billion, just over half of President Biden's latest offer. Republican negotiators, led by West Virginia Senator Shelley Moore Capito, said that it's a serious attempt at finding common ground.
There's a real hunger for bipartisanship in the United States Senate. There's a real ability to achieve that, and we're hoping that this moves the ball forward.
The president said he is talking with Capito, but he suggested he won't wait much longer before trying to pass his plan with Democrats alone. A key sticking point is how to pay for it. Republicans oppose raising corporate taxes. They want to tap unused pandemic relief money, which Democrats oppose. In San Jose, California, the sheriff says that a gunman appeared to target specific victims yesterday at a rail yard where he worked. He shot 9 people to death and then himself. Investigators looked for more evidence at the rail yard and the man's home today. They say that he fired 39 rounds from semi-automatic handguns. It is also reported that he was detained by customs officers in 2016 and talked about hating his workplace. China fired back today at President Biden's call for U.S. intelligence agencies to find the origins of COVID-19. That includes whether it escaped from a Chinese research lab. Beijing charged that the U.S. has no interest in facts or truth. Meanwhile, Facebook announced that it will stop removing claims that COVID is man-made. We'll return to this story after the news summary. The UN Human Rights Council has voted to investigate Israel's treatment of Palestinians in the wake of the Israeli-Hamas war. The UN's human rights chief said today that Israeli airstrikes on Gaza may have been war crimes. The Israeli ambassador insisted Hamas bears the blame. They addressed a virtual session.
Airstrikes in such densely populated areas resulted in a high level of civilian fatalities and injuries, as well as the widespread destruction of civilian infrastructure.
The resolution does not mention Hamas, does not mention the more than 4,400 rockets that were launched at Israeli civilians indiscriminately.
The United States criticized the Council's vote as, quote, a distraction that adds nothing to diplomatic efforts. Syria's President Bashar Assad has been reelected in a vote that Western nations branded a sham. Government officials say that he won 95% of the vote on Wednesday. Syria has been ravaged by a 10-year war pitting Assad's dictatorship against rebels. Lawmakers in Hong Kong approved sweeping election changes today to give mainland China more control. They are adding more pro-Beijing legislators and cutting the number elected by the public. Candidates will also be checked for loyalty to Beijing. Back in this country, the U.S. Senate confirmed Christine Wormuth as the first woman to become Army Secretary. The vote was unanimous. Wormuth takes over amid problems of sexual assault and racial tensions in the ranks. New claims for unemployment benefits dropped again in the last week to 406,000. And on Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 141 points to close at 34,464. The Nasdaq fell 1 point. The S&P 500 added nearly 5. Still to come on the NewsHour, new details on the federal gun watchdog agency's preferential treatment of the gun industry. New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy discusses recovering from the pandemic. Countless veterans return from war with serious illnesses after exposure to toxic burn pits, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Where did COVID-19 come from? At the moment, it raises more questions than clear answers. President Biden wants U.S. intelligence to determine if the virus jumped from animals to humans or somehow escaped from a lab in China. Amna Nawaz looks at what we know now.
That's right, Judy. The Trump administration emphasized it thought the coronavirus leaked from the Wuhan Institute of Virology in southern China, but the U.S. intelligence community has been split over this. Nick Schifrin's been reporting on this all day. He joins me now. Nick, it's good to see you. Let's just start with President Biden's call for this review. Why is this coming now?
Senior administration official says the overall motivation is that the world needs greater clarity on the origins of COVID-19 in order to prevent the next pandemic. But this week, the Biden team took a front to China's rejecting any calls to further investigation. Senior official tells me back in March, President Biden requested an assessment of the intelligence of the origins and that he received that. But on Tuesday, China rejected once again a call for a further investigation. And a senior official says that that led the White House to accelerate their declassification of the origins of COVID, leading to yesterday's statement, calling for the intelligence community to redouble their efforts and a promise to release more information in the next 3 months.
Well, Nick, as Judy mentioned, one of the theories is that the virus escaped from a lab. What's the evidence for that?
Yeah, since the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, the intelligence community has examined the possibility that COVID-19 leaked from the Wuhan Institute of Virology, whose scientists have admitted in the past that they've experimented with bat viruses, including by making them more lethal, and of course happens to be in Wuhan. And last fall, the U.S. received new information that led to a State Department statement that said that several researchers at the lab became sick with a COVID-like 19 illness in the fall of 2019. The lab had a separate military-run area, and the lab, quote, altered and then removed online records of its work. Two former senior officials told me that those researchers got so sick, they were hospitalized. But initially, the Biden team said that none of that is a smoking gun. In fact, in March, a senior intelligence official told me that that statement was, quote, not a complete story. The fact is, Amna, that the intelligence community has failed to create a definitive assessment. COVID could have leaked from the lab. COVID could have jumped from animals to humans. All of those theories are low to medium confidence within the intelligence community, and there's not even an agreement about them. The fact is, there is no new intelligence today, according to officials, but a senior administration official tells me the White House thinks the intelligence community can do more and is trying to provide more resources to examine big data to the intelligence community to do so.
So, Nick, what does that mean? If they can do more, does that mean they could come up with a less ambiguous statement at some point?
I think it's a very good question, and the answer is simple. No, a senior administration official admits that they may not have a definitive answer. The fact is, intelligence officials try to be definitive, but they provide the answers that they have. And the fact is, the intelligence community has looked at this profusely in the last year and a half. They have not had a definitive answer, and they may not have one in the future either.
Nick, what about political pressure back here in the U.S.? How much of a factor is that in all of this?
There's certainly pressure from Republicans who have and are threatening to call President Biden weak on China. In fact, just yesterday, legislation sponsored by Republican Senators Josh Hawley and Mike Braun calling on the administration to declassify their intelligence on the origins of COVID passed unanimously. Administration officials also acknowledge they feel a different kind of pressure, a pressure to use the power of the presidency to convince Americans that they are taking this seriously.
Nick, what about the origin of this? Why is it so important for officials to figure that out?
Yeah, scientists say that the world needs to know the origin of COVID-19 to prevent the next pandemic. And this administration believes that China has more answers when it comes to the origin than the United States does. And that is simply unacceptable to them. You know, just yesterday, Amna, the White House's top Asia official said that the era of U.S.-China engagement had come to an end and the future relationship would be one of competition, clearly, Amna, including over the origins of COVID-19.
Nick Schifrin reporting on the latest for this. Looks like there's a long way to go for some answers. Good to see you, Nick.
Thanks very much.
The shooting in San Jose that took 9 lives is the latest in a spike of mass shootings. In fact, the U.S. is averaging more than 10 a week this year, according to the Gun Violence Archive. The archive defines a mass shooting as one where 4 or more people are injured or killed. It has led many to ask once again about guns and what can be done. Stephanie Tsai looks at the role of the federal government's chief watchdog, that is, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, in a conversation she taped a short time ago.
Judy, a new investigation by USA Today and The Trace finds that the ATF, which is in charge of policing the gun industry, is, quote, frequently toothless and conciliatory, bending over backward to go easy on wayward dealers and sometimes allowing guns to flow into the hands of criminals. A team of reporters looked at more than 2,000 gun inspections between 2015 and 2017. It found too many cases of dealers breaking the law without significant punishment and managers who overrode recommendations to revoke gun licenses. It also found that dealers were inspected only once every 7 years on average. Nick Penzenstadler of USA Today is one of the lead investigative reporters and joins me now. Nick, thank you so much for your time. I read the report. It's comprehensive. And every time there's another mass shooting in this country, we ask these questions. Where can this cycle be broken? Your investigation focuses on that point of sale of the gun. What did you find that the ATF is falling short on there? And what's an example you found?
Right. We found a two-part problem here. We found gun sellers not following the rules and not living up to their promise to do the paperwork correctly and to ask for identification and record all the information about gun buyers correctly. And then we also found the ATF, who came to inspect those gun shops, not following up on their inspections and revoking licenses or doing any meaningful punishment to correct this action.
You specifically found that field investigators are coming up with recommendations and warnings. In some cases, they're recommending that a license to sell a gun be revoked, and higher-ups are overruling that. I guess the question is, why is that happening?
Well, there's tremendous pressure to not shut down a gun shop, especially for these paperwork errors, but we're really focused on these willful violations when a gun shop is given a second chance and a third chance, and they still can't seem to get it right. And many times a field investigator, like you said, will recommend them for revocation, but then a higher up will give them some more leniency and another chance to reform. And that's really based on this effort to get compliance versus shutting down a business.
Are there valid reasons for why they would overrule a recommendation to revoke a license? Is it because they want to keep businesses open, or is there something more nefarious you found?
We certainly saw many reasons. I mean, we saw reasons ranging from this shop just opened, we need to give them a chance to get their feet under them, to this shop has been open for decades, let's give them a break because this is only a few mistakes in hundreds and thousands of sales. So we also saw that number based on volume. If a shop sold a ton of guns and they had a small number of errors, obviously the ATF would give them a little more leniency. But really the concern is that the ATF is unwilling or unable to shut down shops because of the political pressure and the legal resources it takes to string those out.
Because of political pressure. And gun shop owners seem to understand that. Your report suggests that former ATF officials believe that this culture of leniency is understood by gun shop owners. So are we just talking about owners not filling out paperwork, Nick, or are we talking about real-world consequences? Did you find a connection between criminality and the lack of oversight that you report by the ATF?
Yes. I mean, we found shops that were repeatedly warned that they were selling to straw buyers, the people who are prohibited and having someone else stand in for them. And then, you know, months down the line, a gun purchased by a straw buyer is used in a violent crime. So, yes, these actions are not just paperwork issues. This is the crux of many criminal investigations where police are looking at the records generated from these sales to identify where guns came from. So this is a crucial link that the FBI and local police use to solve crime.
And Nick, what is the ATF's explanation for this leniency?
The word from the ATF is that, you know, they really only go after the willful violators. They're only going to focus on the most serious issues, and they only have the resources to go after so many. There's also a federal law that says a gun shop can only be inspected once a year, and obviously they're not even hitting that, averaging about one every 7 years.
President Biden's current pick for heading up the ATF is known to be a staunch proponent of gun control. Do you see him having the authority to change this culture at the ATF if he is confirmed?
Yes. David Chipman was on the Hill yesterday talking about this exact issue. One of his main points is that, these shop owners should be alerting local authorities when someone comes in and tries to buy a gun illegally. If they are prohibited, they fill out the paperwork as committing a felony, it's likely that they could go on and commit more violent felonies. So that was an issue that came up yesterday, and a lot of these problems could be solved with administrative action that don't require new laws, don't require this big political fight. It's really about focusing resources and changing how we view this regulatory structure from leniency and second chances and compliance to more of a crackdown.
Nick Penzenstadler, journalist with USA Today, thank you.
You're welcome.
And shortly after Stephanie recorded that interview, officials at the ATF wrote back with a response. It plans to hire, it says, 100 more investigators in the next year to increase compliance and enforcement. When there's willful disregard for regulations, the ATF says it will seek criminal prosecutions. Rules for how to stay safe are changing quickly as COVID vaccination rates increase nationwide. New Jersey was once among the hardest hit states, but infections are now low. Just 350 plus new cases reported yesterday. Governor Phil Murphy announced that many indoor masking requirements in public places will be lifted this Memorial Day weekend. The state also expects schools to fully reopen in the fall with very limited virtual learning. And Governor Murphy joins me now. Governor, very good to have you with us again. So tell us first, overall, how is the state of New Jersey doing in the battle against COVID?
Right now, Judy, very well. Thanks to the efforts of literally millions of New Jerseyans, they've done the right thing overwhelmingly, and we feel like we've got this thing on the run at long last. As you rightfully pointed out, New Jersey got clobbered, particularly early on, and then we had the second wave that others had. We've lost over 26,000 of our residents, but as I sit with you today, we are in very good shape, and God willing, it'll stay that way.
And Governor, you have announced new rules for public places indoors. People don't have to wear masks in many circumstances. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So beginning tomorrow, Judy, you're exactly right. Based on the public health metrics and the progress we've made, we've already said for a long time, if you're outside, you don't need to wear a mask. Now we're saying if you're inside, if you're vaccinated, you don't need to wear a mask and you don't need to worry about social distancing. We're opening up completely our outdoor capacities. It's a big step. I mean, we've been pointing toward Memorial Day since December. And early on, it was tough sledding, but I'm really happy we're able to take these steps. It's the Jersey summer. It's the Jersey summer on the shore that kicks off tomorrow. I hope, God willing, it'll be a great step toward a great recovery.
But Governor, as we understand it, it is pretty much an honor system. You're asking people, whether it's in the workplace or another public place, to trust that others without masks have been vaccinated. What made you comfortable in going ahead with that?
Well, first of all, Judy, our vaccination program is in full force. We've put over 8.5 million shots into arms. About 4 million New Jerseyans right now are fully vaccinated. Our goal is to get to 4.7 million by the end of next month. I believe we'll get there. And secondly, folks have done the right thing. You know, we talk since the beginning about the knuckleheads who did something wrong or stupid in this pandemic. There are, in fact, very few of them. Folks by the millions in our state did the right thing. And lastly, I don't want to put the burden on the supermarket employee or the hardware store employee to be the judge and jury on who's got a vaccine and who doesn't. We're asking folks to take personal responsibility and do the right thing. And we've done that before, and I'm confident we could do it again.
And Governor, you've had another big decision to make, as we mentioned, and that is saying that your schools will be open in person for all children starting in the fall. What makes that feel like the right decision to you when these children are not going to be that? We don't know in any way whether they're going to be vaccinated by then.
On the right decision question, we just feel again like we've got the virus on the run. The vaccination rollout in New Jersey has gone not a straight line, and we still have a lot of ground to cover on equity in brown and black communities. But I am completely confident that we'll continue to have a strong program. And thirdly, the learning loss, the mental health impact on kids, their families, educators has been overwhelming. So we're going to be back in school Monday through Friday full on, but it may well be with public health parameters because of, among other things, your very fair point. We now have vaccines that are authorized down to the age of 12. There are vaccines in trial for younger kids, but they're not yet approved. So my guess is we're going to see some combination of public health parameters, at least at the beginning of the school year, to make sure we can open up safely and responsibly.
And even aside from those who are vaccinated, we're already hearing from parents who are saying, if my child is immunocompromised or has some other health issue, has disabilities, I'm not comfortable yet having that child go back into the classroom.
Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, New Jersey's got a great longstanding track record of watching out for kids and educators and staff who have got serious medical issues. That will not change. But secondly, I have to say 3.5 months from now in a pandemic with the numbers going in the right direction, it might as well be a lifetime. I really believe that we will be in a very strong position and very, very much able safely and responsibly to open up wide in September.
Well, but will parents be able to appeal in individual situations? Because I'm thinking parents from all around the country are listening to these conversations right now.
Sure. Yeah. The answer is they always have been able to. We've always in New Jersey made accommodations. I think the bar has been historically very high for that. And my guess is it will continue to be high. But absolutely, we're not going to put someone's life at risk. And we wouldn't be making the steps we're taking to say definitively school will be open if we thought we were putting folks' lives at risk. But clearly, we will not do that.
And one other thing on the schools, Governor, I saw that the head of your largest teachers union saying the other day that she says there are still many school buildings in New Jersey that don't meet minimum standards for the health and safety of students and educators. How do you respond?
Yeah, we've heard the same. And the fact of the matter is we've got either a lot of old buildings and or buildings that are old with older ventilation and other systems. We've been chopping through these facilities. We'll continue to. The American Rescue Plan money that we've gotten is going to be a big accelerant in our ability to get to that sooner than later, particularly with ventilation systems. But it's a work in progress, but I'm highly confident we're going to get there.
And finally, Governor, what is the worry that you have as we head hopefully toward a much better place with this pandemic?
You know, I hope that we continue to do the right thing, and I am highly confident that we will. Again, by the millions, for all the press and focus, including from yours truly, on the folks who are not playing by the rules, folks just doing the right thing, enjoying the summer responsibly, getting outside and continuing along. The health metrics are really strong right now. We expect them to continue, but we'll watch them like a hawk. And again, we've paid an enormous price here, but we are clearly in better days right now.
Governor Phil Murphy of New Jersey, we thank you so much again for joining us on the NewsHour. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Judy.
T tens of thousands of U.S. veterans who served in Afghanistan and Iraq are sick and have had to fight to get their illnesses recognized as linked to their service. It is a critical step to qualify for medical and disability benefits. Congress is considering legislation to change all that. That story now from producer Dan Segalin and our John Yang.
He said, I can't get up. The only time this headache is manageable is if I'm laying flat on my back. And so it was a trip to urgent care and then to the ER. They came back and said there's a mass in his brain and we think it's cancerous.
Jennifer Howard has to speak for her husband, Jason. At age 44, he's barely conscious.
I have other types of pizza too. If you get through all of this.
The reason? Glioblastoma, an aggressive brain cancer that usually occurs in much older adults.
They came in and said life expectancy with this type of tumor is not long. Make the best of your time that you have.
Jason served two tours in Iraq as a Marine. He was always fit and healthy and loved to run marathons.
When they came back, they talked a bit about how everything was on fire. They burned everything.
Jason took these photos of the thick, noxious smoke that billowed from the burn pits on the bases in Iraq where he served in 2003 and 2004.
We have a burn pit down here.
In Iraq and Afghanistan, the U.S. military burned all its trash in open-air pits.
I have no idea what they're burning over there.
From plastic water bottles, styrofoam, and batteries, to tires, electronic equipment, and paint cans. Sometimes jet fuel was used as an accelerant. The smoke permeated the bases where the service members slept, ate, and worked.
Hey, Jason.
It's your parents.
Jennifer believes burn pits caused her husband's cancer. And she says the Department of Veterans Affairs made her jump through hoops to prove a direct connection between his exposure and his cancer before granting benefits.
I talked to that 1-800-VA number to see where our claim is. They said, oh, well, we're finally sending it over so that you can get scheduled for his evaluation. And I said, are we going to do it before he dies? And I said it just like that, not yell. And I was told to calm down. They wanted me to drive him to the VA for an in-person exam, which he wasn't like this, but I would not have been able to put him in a car, so I had to file an appeal to have an in-home exam done.
According to data obtained by the NewsHour, of the 2.5 million veterans who served in the global war on terrorism, almost 43,000 filed a claim for cancer. One prominent veteran who died from glioblastoma, President Biden's eldest child, Beau. He was exposed to burn pit smoke when he deployed to Kosovo in the late 1990s and to Iraq in 2009. In a 2018 interview with Judy Woodruff, for the first time, Mr. Biden spoke publicly about burn pits and his son's cancer.
I think they play a significant role. Science has recognized there are certain carcinogens that when people are exposed to them, depending on the quantities, the amount, the water, the air, can have a carcinogenic impact on the body. And just like we know now, you don't want to live underneath a smokestack where carcinogens are coming out of it. We say you got to put a scrubber on. You can't let this stuff get in the air.
He raised the issue in his presidential campaign.
A lot of folks who served in Afghanistan and Iraq and even in parts of Kosovo are exposed to what we call burn pits. We should make it a law because there's more people who are coming home with brain injuries and tumors as a consequence of this. But the point is, every single veteran should not have to prove and wait till science demonstrates beyond a doubt that that's the direct cause.
That is what we live next to.
Lung disease is another condition Iraqi and Afghan war veterans have in large numbers. More than 780,000 of them have filed a VA claim for respiratory conditions. James Raines is one of them.
You know, all the contaminants from the burn pits, I was basically breathing those in every other day at a high level and didn't even realize it at the time.
This burn pit was at the end of the runway at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, where Raines was deployed in 2006 and 2007. Raines says he could always smell the smoke when he jogged on base. When he returned home, his health deteriorated.
I gradually noticed that it became more difficult and more difficult to run. My times were slipping and I started having problems, and I was close to, you know, basically reaching a point where I was going to fail the Army physical fitness test.
Raines was diagnosed with constrictive bronchiolitis, a rare lung condition that makes it hard to breathe, especially when exercising.
I can walk some, but, you know, in the past I would, you know, mow my yard with a push mower just for exercise, but that's, you know, very difficult now.
The VA denied Raines disability compensation. His appeal is pending.
This is a moral outrage.
Now, lawmakers want to change how the VA deals with veterans exposed to burn pits.
Our veterans coming home from war only have to start a new battle with the VA for the care and benefits they've earned.
This is the price of sending men and women to dangerous places to do dangerous things.
Two senators, New York Democrat Kirsten Gillibrand and Florida Republican Marco Rubio, are sponsoring a bill that would require the VA to give benefits to any veterans who served in Iraq, Afghanistan, or a nearby nation and have conditions such as cancer or lung disease. The legislation would also cover veterans who served in the Middle East since 1990, the year of Operation Desert Shield, the U.S. troop buildup before the invasion of Iraq. Gillibrand says veterans and their families shouldn't have the burden of proving that burn pits cause their illnesses.
We know what was burned in a burn pit. We know what's emitted from these kinds of burn pits. We have the epidemiology, and that's why it has to be presumptive. It should not be on them. It should be on us. It is our duty and our responsibility. During
their time, a high-profile backer is lobbying for their bill.
You can't support the troops and then abandon them when the troops need support.
Your indifference.
Former Daily Show host John Stewart advocated for the first responders who searched the rubble in Lower Manhattan after 9/11 and developed similar illnesses.
It's an embarrassment to the country, and it is a stain on this institution.
The VA should function as an advocate for care for the veteran, not as an obstacle, not as like an insurance company where you come in and somebody sits back and says, prove it. Prove that just because you slept next to a toxic waste stew for 24 hours a day and now you have a glioblastoma, prove it. I mean, they've set an impossible bar.
While the Congressional Budget Office hasn't estimated the cost of providing disability compensation for these veterans, the bill's advocates say it's irrelevant. It's a cost of war.
As far as the money is concerned, it should be baked into the pie. You know, you don't get to order a meal and then, you know, when it comes back, oh yeah, I'm not paying for this, you know, the potatoes. You go, hey man, you ordered it. You don't get to, at the back end of it, go, yeah, we don't have any money for that. That's the total cost of war. That's the true cost of war. And you can't just have money for war and the toys of war and not for the consequences of it. And that's really what we're dealing with. It's absurd.
I do not believe that VA treats folks like we're an insurance company. In fact,
VA Deputy Undersecretary Ronald Burke says of the 2.5 million Iraq and Afghan war veterans, more than half have had their claims approved for respiratory problems alone. He says the VA is working to improve how claims are processed.
The secretary has committed publicly and privately that this is a top issue for him. And in essence, we understand that the current process is cumbersome. It is not a friendly process, if you will, from the veteran's perspective.
To help them gather more data, the VA encourages veterans to sign up on their burn pit registry and to file a claim. They are not enthusiastic about the proposed legislation.
This is a very complex issue. And our position is, using the new holistic approach that the secretary has demanded that we utilize, we're going to find better outcomes. To rush to a piecemeal approach right now, we don't believe is meeting the intent or the goal of a holistic, thorough, but expedient review.
Dr. David Shulkin, VA Secretary under Donald Trump, disagrees.
I think that this legislation is what's needed now. It gives veterans the immediate help that they're looking for. They've waited too long to get this type of help. There needs to be better definition on how VA can help veterans. That needs to come from Congress, and that needs to be supported then by the president for the law to change.
For Jen Howard, this legislation can't come soon enough.
I know that there are other caregivers out there and vets that don't have the support that I have. That's why when Jason and I talked, we both felt that he wanted to be counted and he wanted other vets to be able to be counted. So that's why this legislation is so important.
20 days after we spoke with her, her husband, Jason, died. He was 44. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang.
Just heartbreaking. And just today, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs said it is considering giving vets who served in Southwest Asia since 2001 automatic benefits for some chronic respiratory conditions like asthma, rhinitis, and sinusitis. Senator Gillibrand said that that's a good first step, but it is still far from enough. It was a day like no other recently for several of the world's biggest oil and gas companies. Three major firms suffered hits in court and among their own investors yesterday. This comes as pressure is mounting from many fronts for businesses and governments to get more aggressive about curtailing the emissions that are driving the dangerous warming of our planet. William Brangham explores the significance of these developments.
Yes, Judy, it was a stunning day. First, citing the severe consequences of climate change, a court in the Netherlands ruled that Royal Dutch Shell must dramatically cut its greenhouse gas emissions over the next decade. Then, here in the U.S., a majority of Chevron's shareholders voted that the company has to do more to limit its emissions. And then, ExxonMobil's shareholders, over the strong objections of management, elected two new board members, people who have both promised to act on climate change. For more on what this all means, we've brought back Dr. Leah Stokes. She's a political scientist with particular expertise in environmental and energy policy. She teaches at UC Santa Barbara. Dr. Stokes, great to have you back on the NewsHour. As someone who has long advocated that oil and gas companies need to do a better job with regards to their emissions, this must have been a stunning day for you.
Absolutely. I mean, it wasn't just one company, it was three. These are all three really big events, and they all happened to fall on the same day.
Let's talk a little specifically about the Shell ruling, which Shell has said it's going to try to appeal. But if that ruling goes forward and the company has to curtail its emissions quite dramatically, I mean, in some ways, that calls for something of a retooling of its whole business model.
Absolutely. You know, scientists released a report in 2018 which said that the whole planet has to cut emissions by 45% to limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. And so what the ruling said is that Shell has to do the same thing. They need to be cutting their emissions by that 45%. And critically, it's not just their emissions from the operations that they have, it's also from the product that they sell. So this would be a very dramatic shift in how that company operates. But the reality is all fossil fuel companies have to be starting to make these dramatic shifts, and they haven't really been willing to do it without pressure, whether that's from the courts or from shareholders or other activists in society.
And then as we were talking, Exxon and Chevron both faced these internal revolts here from groups that have said basically that you guys have dithered. This is not their words, those are my words. You've dithered long enough about emissions and it's time to get serious. How meaningful do you think those interventions will actually be in those companies' policies?
Well, activists have been trying for quite a long time to get things like shareholder resolutions passed at fossil fuel companies. So the fact that we got such big changes yesterday at both Exxon with the board vote, keep in mind that Exxon has 12 board members, I believe, and a relatively new organization called Engine One said, let's field some new candidates, some people who care about climate change. And why did they do that? Because Exxon is doing very poorly financially. Investors who have been giving their money to this company have have been seeing pretty poor returns. And so shockingly, really large institutional investors like BlackRock, for example, said, you know what, we are going to back those candidates for the board. We want to have different voices. At Chevron, you know, it was a sort of resolution to get the company to similarly think about the effects of its products. So just like the Shell ruling, which said that you have to think about how are your products creating pollution, at Chevron, they're saying, we want you to be thinking about what are the climate impacts of the drug, so to speak, you're selling, which is oil and gas and fossil fuels. So these are really big changes. And it's a tactic that activists have used for a long time, but we're starting to see breakthroughs. And I think that's because investors are seeing that continuing to pretend that climate change is not here is a bad financial decision.
Lastly, this all dovetails with some fairly surprisingly aggressive moves by the Biden administration in its infrastructure plan. Clean electricity, electric vehicles. Do you think that those elements will withstand this pretty well demonstrated Republican opposition to those ideas?
I'm sure hopeful that they will, because we cannot have an infrastructure package without investments in clean electricity, without investments in clean transportation. This is really the pathway forward for job creation in this country. If fossil fuel companies are struggling financially and laying people off, we need to have investments in industries that will be employing people at really good paying wages and cleaning up our air and our water and so much of our infrastructure across this country. So I think that the Biden administration and the Senate and the House Democrats are committed to true climate action, to things like a clean electricity standard, investments in vehicles, investments in clean buildings. And I'm hopeful that at the end of this, the Republican Party, which is very in bed with the fossil fuel industry, will not win the day, and we will see a bold American jobs plan coming out of Congress, hopefully this summer.
All right, Dr. Leah Stokes at UC Santa Barbara, always good to see you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
And on the NewsHour online, you can see a complete profile of beloved children's author and illustrator, Eric Carle, who died this week at 91. Jeffrey Brown visited him at the Eric Carle Museum of Picture Book Art in Amherst, Massachusetts, when it opened in 2002. Eric Carle created imaginary worlds for children through books such as Brown Bear, What Do You See?, The Grouchy Ladybug, and of course, The Very Hungry Caterpillar. It has been translated into more than 66 languages and sold more than 50 million copies. Here is Carle explaining its resonance.
I never imagined that it would become so important to so many children. Why do children love it? It's a book of hope. You little, ugly, little, insignificant bug, you too can grow up to be a beautiful big butterfly and fly into the world and unfold your talents.
And he is clearly one of our all-time favorite writers of children's books. And you can find all of that and more on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.